Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The BBC reports that Moscow has seen nothing like this in years. Two nights of anti-government protests in Moscow and at least two other Russian cities have resulted in over 600 arrests. People are taking to the streets to protest alleged vote rigging in last week's elections. The news is on the front page of Russian newspapers. Russian social media have lit up with commentary, but turn on Russian TV, and it's as if the protests are not happening. Opposition leaders say there will be more protests this weekend, including daily flash mobs and a big rally planned for Saturday in Revolution Square, which is adjacent to the Kremlin. Joining us to talk about coverage and the blackout on Russian TV is Fred Weir, Christian Science Monitor correspondent based in Moscow, and he has been covering the protests. Hi, Fred. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Nice to have you. And on the domestic front, we're talking about media coverage of Wall Street whistleblowers and why the Department of Justice has failed to prosecute even one bank executive despite mounting evidence of fraud. Ryan Chittum follows this closely and recently wrote about a 60 Minutes piece in which two whistleblowers from Countrywide and Citibank said they witnessed crimes by management and wonder why there have not been any criminal prosecutions. Ryan Chittum is staff writer at Columbia Journalism Review and a former staff reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Hi, Ryan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Ryan, I know in your piece you gave kudos to 60 Minutes, but what else did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I mean, that Steve Croft piece was kind of my favorite piece of the week, and it built off earlier work by other reporters. There's a report out today in the Times I like. It's not a huge story, but Edward Wyatt of the New York Times is writing about how the SEC settled with Wachovia and how that settlement differs from the Justice Department. The Justice Department forced Wachovia to admit wrongdoing, and the SEC did not. It lets Wachovia say, it doesn't admit or deny, culpability in the case, which makes it harder for civil suits and, private people to sue Wachovia over this. So it's an interesting catch by Ed Wyatt. It's not a huge story, but, it's just kind of a what reporters ought to be doing.
What struck me in the 60 Minutes piece, and I haven't really seen this focused on in many other pieces, is that the Department of Justice has the authority to put people in jail. The SEC does not. And basically the piece said that the DOJ has teeth and the SEC does not.
Right. I mean, the SEC can file civil suits against individuals and companies. It regulates the companies. The Department of Justice obviously files criminal suits. So they kind of work hand in hand sometimes, but the SEC, the Department of Justice, if it's not focusing on these issues like the SEC is, that's its main responsibility is regulating the financial industry. If it can't file criminal charges against somebody, it's just not going to have that much firepower to enforce, enforce the law.
Right.
It can, and, like Goldman Sachs in the Abacus deal, the SEC fined them $500 million. That's not exactly toothless to be able to fine somebody $500 million. But, without that without the ability to prosecute crimes and put people in jail, its enforcement ability is limited. And, even it's hard to say, even if it had criminal prosecution, the right to prosecute criminals, whether it would do it, because it's not exactly been aggressive in finding companies and individuals in the financial crisis.
Right. And we'll talk in more detail about this specifically and about the 60 Minutes piece later in the show. That's Ryan Chittum. He's a staff writer with the Columbia Journalism Review and a former staff reporter with the Wall Street Journal. And what about you, Fred? You're in Moscow. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I suppose the stars here are the literally scores of amateur journalists who've filled up Russian Facebook, the Live Journal, the Russian language of Kontakte with their accounts of vote fraud, of coercion, you know, with eyewitness accounts, with amateur videos done on cell phones and so on, showing irregularities in the polling stations and so on. This has been just an amazing source of information. I guess the star of all is the head of this Kontakte, a man named Pavel Durov, who not only resisted an order from the FSB, which is the former KGB, to bar seven different groups from Kontakte, which is like a Russian version of Facebook, but he actually published the FSB's letter on Kontakte. So we see here kind of in Russia people breaking out of, of the sort of straitjacket that they were seen to be in the past, and using these social media to really not just connect with each other, but to inform each other and the world at large.
Video clips on France 24 show erasable inks being used in the polling stations and also polling officials falsifying ballots. What else do the irregularities show?
Well, most of what is claimed happened not so much in the polling stations, although there was quite a lot of things like inflating the voter tallies, where the director of a polling station would have two sets of books, one showing the actual number of voters that had come in, and one which he would produce later showing, say, twice as many voters coming in to vote, and then he would fill up the difference with ballots that he'd prepared later. We have on Russian Facebook someone videotaping that on their cell phone. Cases where the protocols, which are documents that certify the raw vote count in a polling station, people would photograph those. You know, they're posted in the polling station after the vote count is completed. People would photograph those and then go and check at what is reported in the Territorial Electoral Commission, and they photograph that and find often wild discrepancies. There's a lot of stuff like that, which we know must have taken place in previous elections. It's just that people didn't go out of their way and show the courage to actually document it. And maybe, 10 years ago, the technology, the cell phones and so on, didn't exist either. This is really remarkable.
Well, talk more about that, because the BBC reports that Moscow has seen nothing like this in years. And then for your piece in the Christian Science Monitor, you report that for more than a decade, Russians appear to have quietly accepted Vladimir Putin's system of, quote, managed democracy. How unprecedented are these actions in the streets?
Well, if we're speaking now about the protests, yes, that's quite, we did have protests early in the Putin era, what we call the Putin era, when the government tried a rather ham-handed reform of social benefits that mainly affected the elderly. And the older people are, strangely enough, the best organized of Russians. They have, like, veterans organizations. They have other, associations of senior citizens. And they took to the streets and forced, this was almost, about 8 years ago, and forced the Putin government to completely change their projected reforms. So, but that was a different social demographic and a different set of issues. Since then, we have had a very quiescent society, and people have even gotten to, you can find people writing that Russians are okay with this, that there's a sort of social contract that they've made with authorities in which they permit the authorities to run things their way in exchange for the undoubted relative prosperity that has occurred in the Putin era. I think it does need to be pointed out that the past 10 years have been one of the happiest decades in Russian history. Living standards have increased by some estimates about four times over, and that especially affects the poorer strata of society. It has been a time of massive oil revenues for the Russian government, but Putin was rather wise in redistributing that and doing a lot of other things, building infrastructure and so on. So Putin's popularity is rooted in that decade of stability, but it was also a time in which this political system, in which basically the Kremlin dictates who's going to sit in parliament, who's going to be elected your president, also, Putin canceled a lot of elections and made governors of regions and so on an appointed position. All that has been the political face of this past decade.
That is Fred Weir. He's a Christian Science Monitor correspondent based in Moscow, and he'll be with us for about 10 more minutes. So if you have any questions or comments about what is happening in Russia, there have been over 600 arrests so far, and there is a planned protest this Saturday. They have a permit for just a couple hundred people, but opposition candidates are hoping that as many as 10,000 people take to the streets. So if you have any questions or comments about what's going on in Russia and specifically media coverage, what do you make of how the media is covering this? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And then after the break, we'll be talking about coverage of Wall Street fraud. And if there was any other story that you'd like to talk about this week, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. So before we talk more about social media, and I'd like to bring Ryan in to talk about that, Fred, why don't you tell us what were the final election results?
Well, the election results this time, I think, showed pretty much that this system that developed under Putin has reached its limits. It does permit a spectrum of parties to take part in the elections. It also bans parties that don't play by the rules or don't accept having their candidate list edited by Kremlin apparatchiks and so on. But even those parties, like the Communist Party of the Russian Federation, Yabloko, which is a liberal party, those parties did accept Kremlin rules and so on, and they also were compelled to limit their campaigning. They're put under a lot of restraints, while the main party, the United Russia Party, gets vast official resources, almost exclusive access to the state media, which includes most of the television stations and so on. And despite that, the United Russia Party got less, just under 50%, which is way down from the 64% that it had last time, and the votes for especially the Communist Party and another sort of leftish party, which is called A Just Russia, really increased. And that is even after all of the alleged falsifications, fraud, and so on that is still being sorted out. In fact, a group of opposition parties held a press conference here the other day and released their own survey of about over 100 polling stations, from which the projections would show that United Russia, which is Putin's party, probably only got about a third of the votes, actually, and was outpolled by the Communist Party. Now, that's just one projection, and it's certainly a partisan one. But it's widely believed here that that the United Russia seriously jiggered the elections, picked the elections.
So, how do you think this will ultimately be dealt with?
Well, first of all, we have these protests, and they were escalating during the week in some ways. And tomorrow, we will see how extensive in Moscow the protest really is. I should correct your earlier report, because today there have been some developments. both sides kind of stepped back a little bit and compromised. The opposition agreed to accept another venue for their demonstration tomorrow, and authorities agreed to let them have up to 30,000 people.
Oh.
And indeed, in the Facebook page that they have, over 35,000 people have signed a pledge to take part in this rally tomorrow. So there, because the authorities clearly stepped back from the confrontational position that they had, and the opposition also compromised, there's a good hope that there won't be violence or mass arrests tomorrow, that the authorities will simply let this rally take place, and then we'll see. The steam might be off. You know, it's not my impression that there is a revolutionary mood here. It isn't like them and us, at least not yet. Mm. Of course, we have a bloodbath in the streets of Moscow, everything will change dramatically. But if the authorities allow a mass rally to take place, and if they follow that up by offering to investigate some of the more egregious allegations of vote rigging and so on, we might see this whole situation calm down.
Has Facebook and other forms of social media become a main source for you, Fred, and other and your colleagues in Russia?
Well, yes. In this particular week, past week, yes, very much so. And I have found myself consulting it every day. And I have friends and my wife who is an avid user of Kontakte and so on, who send me stuff, share stuff with me, so I get to see a lot of this. I never had a great interest in it before because I'm a political reporter. but this week, yes, definitely, I've been riveted.
Well, welcome to your new addiction, Fred. Ryan, what are your thoughts on that? Because social media, it's incredible when you think about the role that it plays. I mean, those of us that are on it every day sort of take it for granted until we hear stories like this. But in many of the pieces I've read about media, they're citing newspapers, television, and Facebook.
Right. Yeah, and I sort of have a love-hate relationship with social media. You know, I mean, I love it, but at times it is addicting, and it feels like it's taking up so much of my time to stay on top of the stuff. So it's hard to find a balance. But when you see things like what's going on in Russia and how instrumental it is in getting word out about what has happened, this is it's citizen journalism. And, you know, some of these people know what they're doing is kind of a journalism, and other people don't. But it's still coming out, and reporters are able to harness that information and present it to the public in their traditional, you know, sort of gatekeeping function. But at the same time, if they don't, the Russian media is not exactly, Russian language media is not exactly free, then they can go around it to a certain extent and talk to other people. I mean, it's just a revolutionary thing.
And also, it seems like citizen journalism is becoming much more accessible to seasoned journalists. I mean, they're looking to citizen journalists to find out what's really happening on the ground.
Yeah, I think so. If you look at a Twitter stream and you search Russia, you're going to have, 5 billion tweets scrolling by every second, and so you can't do that. But some of these things, Egyptian Spring, the Arab Spring, Andy Carvin of NPR was filtering, the Twitter feeds and finding citizen journalists on the ground and sort of vetting them and acting as a filter for other reporters to find sources of information to use. And it was an extremely valuable tool for journalists trying to report on what was happening in the Middle East. And, I sense that if you just have this fire hose of information, that's not extremely valuable. You have to have people who can sort through it and select the best information, vet it, figure out what's accurate and what's not. And in these days, we kind of have to figure out what may be accurate.
Right.
Well, and then pass it on to their readers.
And as you were talking about Twitter, I just searched, Fred, for Russia and protest. And Stephanie Gosk with NBC News is reporting that the Department of Education in Russia says there are now mandatory classes on Saturday, same time as the government opposition protest. Have you heard anything about this?
No, but it sounds typical. They also announced, quite by surprise, in the middle of last week that the Revolution Square, which was the first venue for the demonstrations, would be closed for urgent waterworks repairs. And indeed, crews were down there fencing off the square today. So this sort of thing, you have to understand that the government can go into a full court press to try to disrupt and block these kinds of manifestations. That's true. And if I could say something about citizen journalism, I don't know if that's an accurate term, because I don't think that bloggers or people posting on social media can replace journalism or even compete with it, but they definitely magnify and extend the sources available to journalists. I mean, it's just as if you go out into the street and you talk to people, which I often do. You don't treat each of those as expert sources, but this vox populi thing, the experiences of people, their firsthand accounts of events are really important in journalism and always were.
Right.
But now, through these social media, you have so many other similar types of sources to turn to, and of course you have to filter through them, you have to read them, you have to take them with a grain of salt, you have to realize that they're just one person's, probably quite one-sided, account of something. You treat all that the same way you always treated sources, but the more, the better. I think that was always a rule, certainly of mine. The more you can get, the more you see, the more people you talk to, the better your picture.
Well, we have a call on this, and I want to make sure we get to it before break. Let's hear from David in Millbrae. Hi, David.
Hi, am I on?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, this might be a little off the subject, but to me it seems like everybody wants to rush into a war with Iran, and there's both a nationalistic and an internationalistic view, and they're taking the more nationalistic view. The internationalistic view, of course, would be having the Security Council heavily involved because it involves the non-proliferation treaty. But how do you think Russia feels, or what do you think they're analyzing when it seems like everybody wants to rush head on into some kind of a military action against Iran, and our country's just literally spent trillions of dollars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and I don't know if we could how long we could sustain a conventional war. And of course the whole idea of the non-proliferation treaty is to rein in any idea of a nuclear war. What do you think the Russian view would be if we become adventuristic again in Iran?
Well, thanks for the question, David. And Fred, do you have a couple more minutes to stick around with us? We can get your answer after the break.
Sure.
Okay, great. We're speaking with Fred Weir, Christian Science Monitor correspondent based in Moscow, and Ryan Chittum is a staff writer with the Columbia Journalism Review. And after we get Fred's response, we'll switch gears and talk about Wall Street fraud and Wall Street corruption. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. If there was a story you saw this week that you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
And speaking of Facebook, you could friend us on Facebook. It's another way to spread the word about the programming that you value on local public radio. It's as easy as clicking the link to KALW's Facebook page on our website, kalw.org. And thank you for listening to and supporting your local public radio station, KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. On Monday, we'll have a conversation about the role of community colleges. A student task force is considering plans to restructure community colleges to be geared more towards increasing transfer rates to four-year colleges. But some students and faculty worry these changes will make it harder to access higher education. So what does community college mean to you? You can give us a call and join us on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we're joined by Fred Weir, Christian Science Monitor correspondent based in Moscow, and Ryan Chittum is staff writer with the Columbia Journalism Review and a former staff reporter at the Wall Street Journal. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If there was a story you saw this week that you thought was done well, we'd love to hear about it, or if you have any criticism. And we'll be switching gears in just a minute to talk about Wall Street fraud and why the DOJ has failed to bring even one bank executive, actually failed to prosecute one bank executive despite mounting evidence of fraud. So, Fred, before we let you go, what is your response to David in Millbrae about how Russia... Were you able to hear him?
Yes, I did.
Okay, great.
So the Russian foreign policy position on Iran is, of course, they don't want to see Iran get a nuclear weapon, but they're tremendously skeptical of Western and particularly American approach toward Iran, which seems to be to pressure Iran to make it yield it and not. I think the Russians suspect that the geopolitical goal isn't particularly about nuclear weapons, but about bringing Iran to heel, bringing it back into the Western fold. So the Russians have not cooperated with the latest round of sanctions, and I think they're really, really worried about the prospect of a war breaking out, because Iran is not so far from their own southern border. You know, Iran has the southern shore of the Caspian Sea, and Russia is just at the north end of the Caspian Sea. So I think that Russia would really like to use its influence to try to put the brakes on military action there.
Well, we'll have to do a show specifically on Russia, and we'll definitely be following what happens tomorrow. So thank you so much for joining us, Fred. We'll look for your reporting.
My pleasure.
That is Fred Weir. He is Christian Science Monitor correspondent based in Moscow, and he has been reporting on the protests that have happened this week. Two nights of anti-government protests in at least three Russian cities have resulted in over 600 arrests, and you can find Fred's reporting at yourcallradio.org. And now we are going to switch gears and speak with Ryan Chittum, staff writer at the Columbia Journalism Review, about coverage of Wall Street fraud and why the DOJ has failed to prosecute even one bank executive despite mounting evidence of fraud. So, Ryan, you have been writing about this and following coverage of this. Your latest piece focuses on a 60 Minutes report that asked this very question: why has the DOJ failed to prosecute even one bank executive? What really struck you about this piece?
Well, 60 Minutes is a major news program. It's probably the most important television news program. And Steve Croft, you know, they gave this story half an hour of TV time, mm-hmm. which is a big deal. You know, even 60 Minutes pieces are normally like 10 minutes, maybe 15. So for 60 Minutes to give Croft half an hour to talk about this story in and of itself is a big deal. And it's a good thing the story was really good. He talked to a couple of whistleblowers, one from Countrywide, one from Citigroup, that have gotten, you know, they've gotten not enough attention, I think. And so he's put them in the spotlight. And he's building off, particularly with the Countrywide whistleblower, whose name is Eileen Foster. She was head of fraud investigations at Countrywide, an executive there, and raised all kinds of red flags and was later fired by Bank of America, won a $1 million judgment for wrongful termination of a whistleblower. Michael Hudson, who's a journalist with the Center for Public Integrity, dug her up back in September. So he did a lot of the spade work for this, and I wrote about Hudson's piece back then. And you know, Croft, to his credit, you know, read that story and dug up Foster too and put her on TV talking about how the Justice Department has never contacted her. She's never talked to the Justice Department, which has declined to prosecute Angela Mozzillo and Countrywide. They've come out and said they're not going to do it. They're just going to rely on civil action from the SEC. You'd think that if they'd done a full investigation, they would have talked at some point to the head of fraud investigations at Countrywide, but Foster says they've never done that. And she said that on national TV. Mm. And you know, it's a big deal to get that kind of information out there. This was 3 years old. You know, the crash happened more than 3 years ago, and we're still digging this out.
And that's what's amazing. We'll play a clip from the piece in just a minute, but it really reminded me of a couple documentaries that we featured on this show. And in those documentaries, they spoke to whistleblowers about liars' loans and about these mortgage executives who knew that a family couldn't afford this mortgage, but they lied about how much money they made or how their income. And why is it just piecemeal? You know, we'll give 60 Minutes kudos, and their piece was excellent. But why is this reporting so, you know, it's lacking? Every couple
right.
months, it's sort of, yes, ProPublica did it. Yes, 60 Minutes did it. Why don't we see it more often?
Well, the central problem is that you're talking about the news business, which is focused on what happened today and what's going to happen tomorrow. So it's difficult to get, you know, a drumbeat going on something that happened 3 or 4 years ago, you know, for a newspaper, say. It's just the mindset of editors of the institutions to look forward and to look at what's happening right now. You don't, you know, an old story, it's just going to have a higher bar to get into the paper or on TV or whatever. And there's, you know, it's understandable to a certain extent. But, you know, this is the biggest story, the biggest business story of the last 80 years. And one of the biggest stories, you know, ever. And so if we don't know, you know, we think we know what happened, but we don't really know. I think we know about half of what happened. It's still fertile field for people like Michael Hudson, who I was talking about. You know, in that story that uncovered Eileen Foster, he referenced 30 other Countrywide employees he's talked to who witnessed executives committing crimes, according to them. 30.
Wow.
And this is a reporter. This didn't come out in the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, which had subpoena power, or, you know, so, you know, there's still a lot of work for journalists to do. It's just, you know, it's hard to get the justification to do it. You know, mm-hmm. this is time-intensive, labor-intensive work. The media is not doing well right now, you know, financially. So, and there's more and more pressure to put out blog posts and tweets and stories and video and all this stuff. So you have less time to just spend 2 months looking at what happened 3, 4, 5 years ago.
And follow the horse race of the upcoming presidential election. Let's play a clip from this December 4th 60 Minutes piece. And in this clip, 60 Minutes' Steve Croft is questioning Eileen Foster. She's a former senior executive at Countrywide Financial who investigated fraud.
Do you believe that there are people at Countrywide who belong behind bars?
Yes.
Do you want to give me their names?
No.
Would you give their names to a grand jury if you were asked?
Yes.
But Eileen Foster has never been asked and never spoken to the Justice Department, even though she was Countrywide's executive vice president in charge of fraud investigations. At the height of the housing bubble, Countrywide Financial was the largest mortgage lender in the country, and the loans it made were among the worst, a third ending up in foreclosure or default. Many because of mortgage fraud. It was Foster's job to monitor and investigate allegations of fraud against Countrywide employees and make sure they were reported to the board of directors and the Treasury Department.
How much fraud was there countrywide?
From what I saw, the types of things I saw, it appeared systemic. It wasn't just one individual or two or three individuals. It was branches of individuals. It was regions of individuals.
What you seem to be saying was it was just a way of doing business.
Yes.
That's a clip from a 60 Minutes piece that took a look at Wall Street fraud. And again, that's Eileen Foster, former senior executive at Countrywide Financial, who investigated fraud. It was incredible to hear her story after this clip. She said that they looked specifically at Boston branches, and Countrywide closed 6 of its 8 branches after they found a lot of fraud of mortgage lenders photocopying signatures, for example. 44 out of 60 employees were fired or quit. She said it wasn't just Boston. It was widespread across the country. And she said she took this info up the chain of command and to the audit department. No action was taken. And then Countrywide merged with Bank of America. She was promoted and she was asked to speak with government regulators to discuss fraud reports. But someone at Countrywide asked her basically to spin the situation and downplay it. They asked her to sign a 14-page document that would buy her silence in exchange for a large amount of money. She refused and then she was fired.
Right.
So, and then she spent 3 years trying to clear her name, and she recently won a federal whistleblower complaint against B of A for wrongful termination and was awarded about $1 million in back pay. So
right.
What I kept thinking, if I were a reporter at the White House, I would be asking about this constantly. I mean, you don't have to do that much research. You can just watch these documentaries or the 60 Minutes piece and say, what is your response to Eileen Foster's accusations?
Yeah. I mean, I would too. You know, I think part of the problem there is, there's sort of a perceived split between political reporting and business reporting. And, like you said earlier, these folks are focused on the horse race and things like that. And this is a business story and it's not on their radar, you know. I mean, I can't really speak to why, these questions aren't being asked in press conference. Now, maybe they are being asked, and, you know, the vast majority of questions are asked over the phone in private. I'm sure that they're being asked to a certain extent, but, you know, certainly not of the president or in press conferences that I've seen.
Well, to 60 Minutes credit, Steve Croft did interview Lanny Brewer. He's head of the criminal division at the DOJ, and he asked specifically about this case. And Lanny Brewer said, it's hard for me to talk about specifics. It's in our criminal justice system. We have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. We are going after these cases. And that's pretty much all he said.
Right. Except the kicker of Croft's story was Brewer saying, wait and see. You know, he's been disgusted too, so hold your horse as well. You know, we've heard that how many times, and nothing's happened. So I wouldn't hold my breath. Just to follow up on what I was saying earlier about the coverage of crime, you know, and fraud, there has been a lot of good work done. But it's sporadic, you know, like we were talking about earlier. So it's hard to get a drumbeat going on something that happened 3-4 years ago. And, but that doesn't mean there hasn't been tremendous work. Gretchen Morgenson and Louise Story of the New York Times, I'm thinking of their April piece in particular, that was one of the best things I've read about why there have been no prosecutions. I mean, they had, you know, several scoops in there, including that the FBI had tried to reallocate resources to financial fraud in the wake of the crash, you know, in, I guess it was spring 2008. We hadn't had the full-on crash yet. And the Bush, you know, higher-up said no. The attorney general said no. So, there was an effort by some bureaucrats to do something about this, and bureaucrats higher up said no. Also, you know, Obama's Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner pressured the New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo. New York's Attorney General has historically been aggressive at prosecuting Wall Street fraud, things like Elliot Spitzer. But Geithner pressured him to take it easy on the banks because they were in such rough shape and it might take down the whole economy and the financial system. So, it's not like this just is a natural disaster. This was conscious decision. These were conscious decisions by high-placed political officials in the government, both in the Bush and Obama administrations.
Well, and the evidence that these whistleblowers are exposing about these loan officers forging and manipulating borrowers' income and asset statements to help them get loans they couldn't afford and didn't qualify for. And now we're seeing the results of this because there are just so people are suffering across the country and dealing with foreclosures on a regular basis. Here in California,
right,
we've got so many foreclosures.
Right. And, the loan officers did this. But the key to look at there is not some guy on the ground in Orange County or whatever, talking to customers. Although, if they committed crimes, they should be prosecuted too. But the key is like, what were the incentives that caused them to do this? And the incentives were that mortgage brokers got paid more to put people in subprime loans, and they got bonuses for putting people in loans that charged higher interest rates than they qualified for. So if you qualify for a 5% interest rate and you're a broker and you can con them into paying 9%, then you get paid more as the broker to do that. And the responsibility for that lies in their sales managers, regional managers, on up into the executive suite. And that's where the real action should be at. And it's not easy to get to. I'm not going to say cut and dry cases, but it's clear that we don't have the kind of aggressive regulators and prosecutors that we had in the wake of the SNL crisis, when there were, probably 80 to 90 times as many prosecutions overall as there have been now, including of executives. So there's just been, something's changed, and, part of it is that the system has been fragile and they haven't wanted to, freak everybody out, but that's not a good excuse. The law is the law. It's the law for me. It's the law for you. It's the law for Occupy Wall Street and Zuccotti Park. So the law ought to be the same, applied to executives who took home hundreds of millions of dollars.
We're speaking with Ryan Chittum. He is a staff writer with the Columbia Journalism Review and a former staff reporter with the Wall Street Journal. And we're talking about media coverage, or in some cases, lack of coverage of Wall Street fraud. And just that question, why has the DOJ failed to go after any bank executives despite mounting evidence of fraud? And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What are your thoughts on media coverage of this issue? And if there are any other stories you saw this week that you think deserve more attention, you can give us a call. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Ryan, as a former staff reporter with the Wall Street Journal, what are your thoughts about coverage of this issue there? And do you speak much to your former colleagues about this?
Yeah, I do talk to them, some. I worked there for, almost 6 years, and it's been 4 years now, so I still have some friends that I talk to here and there. But I worked there in the pre-Murdoch days, and the paper has changed pretty radically since Murdoch took over, and since he put Robert Thompson in charge of the paper, and it's become even more news focused. Like what I was talking about earlier about they're not looking back, and they just haven't done a lot of spade work on the crisis since. They did a lot of great work back in 06, 07, and even some in 08, and it's just kind of dried up since then. They're not doing that kind of stuff anymore. And it's a shame, because that was, it is the premier business paper publication in the world. It still is. And it has an outsized influence. And so the people that aren't digging into that, we don't know what we've missed. I we've been critical of the changes at the Journal, and it's not to say that they've made it a right-wing paper, and like a Murdoch mouthpiece, although there have been some troubling instances of you know, bias and what seems like bias. But it's just the you know, dismantling of the what used to be Page One story machine that did these big investigations and long pieces, and now, you know, people are sort of they're pushing out news stories, and you just don't have the time to do that kind of in-depth stuff as much anymore. And when you do, it doesn't seem like they want to go, you know, dig up dead bodies.
Well, we have a caller on this, so let's go to Jason in Salinas. Hi, Jason. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. So the question that I was wondering is that there have been some separate investigative pieces for multiple infractions involving this government that tie back to lobbying and special interest, and that sometimes due justice doesn't happen because there are these sort of deals that have happened behind the scenes and sort of pressures. And my question is there a possibility that there has been some of this special interest lobbying from these banks, these mortgage companies, that have put some of our officials in the Department of Justice higher up in government, and that maybe that's why there's a little bit of trepidation from pursuing this as fully as maybe they regularly would?
Oh, absolutely, Jason. You know, it's hard to tell exactly what kind of lobbying's gone on, although there have been, you know, reports on it, you know, specific instances. But certainly, you know, banks can, you know, tell Tim Geithner that, you know, everybody's nervous, and if you come after us, the thing's going to collapse. So, you know, there's that kind of thing that goes on, and there's more insidious things that we can suspect go on but don't know about. But one of the most problematic things is the revolving door between, you know, for regulators and Wall Street. And that, you know, it affects people. It has to. When you have a job and you're regulating a bank and you're making, you know, $110,000 a year or so, and you're regulating people that are making millions of dollars a year, and they can sort of wink, wink, dangle future job prospects at you, it has an impact on some people. Some people it doesn't. But
well, what do you think is more problematic? Do you think it's the revolving door or money in politics? Because B of A now owns Countrywide, and we just did a little research and found that this year B of A has donated just over $300,000 to all candidates this year. I mean, all things considered, that isn't that much money.
Right. Yeah, you know, I suspect that it's both. I think the revolving door, you know, they're sort of related issues and sort of separate, and it's hard to tell what's more important than the other. That 300 grand is just not much money in the grand scheme of things, but it is, you know. That's the sad thing, is that it does make an impact.
Right. Well,
you know, when you're calling people and asking them to give you money, and you've just, you know, fought to pass a cap on their debit fees that have their what they can charge, you know, that makes it harder to call people and get them to raise money for you.
Well, and when I said it's not that much money, of course it is. But when you look at what they get in return, it seems
right.
Like it's pennies. I mean, it seems like you don't have to give much to these politicians to get everything you want in return. Let's go to our next caller. We only have a couple more minutes. Who's on the line?
William.
Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, this is a different topic, but it has to do with oil drilling. The San Francisco Chronicle, December 3rd, carried a report from Bloomberg News Service, which startled me because I had never heard it before and I haven't heard anything since about it. And what it is that in the past 9 months, the exports of oil and gasoline, both oil total and gasoline in particular, the United States has been exporting three times as much as it's been importing. And we always hear that we have to drill to achieve energy independence.
Right. Well, the problem there is that they're talking about produced petroleum products and not raw petroleum products. So we are now exporting more gasoline than we are importing, but we import millions of barrels a day more raw crude oil than we do than we produce. So, you know, it's a little. I've thought about writing a story about the press coverage of that because it's sort of misleading. It, we're not anywhere close to being energy independent, although, you know, the new sources, they're fracking and doing these kinds of things. They are producing quite a bit more natural gas and oil, but not anywhere near what it would take to support current levels of gas and oil usage in the U.S.
Well, thank you for the call. And we've got a couple more emails, but we're almost out of time, and they're about the Occupy movements. I'll be sure to read these next week, specifically about the Chronicle's coverage and just the lack of coverage about the pepper spray at UC Davis. And final thoughts from you, Ryan, now that the 60 Minutes piece is out, journalists, I mean, they could just take Eileen Foster's quotes. That they also interviewed a former Citigroup vice president, Richard Bowen, who said that 60% of the loans he looked at were fraudulent. Do you think that journalists will actually use this information?
Yeah, and they have been, you know, over the past few years. But, you know, like we said, it's been sporadic. It's hard to get a drumbeat going when this is in, you know, something like an old story. So I guess the conceptualization of the story needs to change, that this is still something that matters, that we've, you know, as far as what we're going to do with our financial system and what our mortgage lending will look like in the future. You know, if we're going to reform things or figure out if we need to reform them, we got to figure out what happened.
Right. Well, we'll continue to follow this. And thank you so much. And thanks to everybody at Columbia Journalism Review for the great work you do. That's Ryan Chittum, staff writer with Columbia Journalism Review and a former staff reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up on Monday. What are community colleges for? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the role of community colleges in higher education. A student task force is considering plans to restructure community colleges to be geared more towards increasing transfer rates to four-year colleges. But students and faculty worry these changes will actually make higher education less accessible. So what do community colleges mean to you? And how can we maximize the potential of this great resource? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.